Find other great podcasts like this one at podmoth.network.
Welcome to the Brutal, Bizarre, and Boozy podcast. I'm Declan, the son.
And I'm Jane, the mom. This is the podcast where we talk about brutal crimes, bizarre occurrences, and get you drunk with cocktails themed around one of our stories. To lighten things up, we'd like to end our time with a chaser. Please keep in mind some of our stories might be upsetting to young or sensitive ears.
We love hearing from our listeners, so feel free to contact us by email or social media. You can find our contact info in the show notes for this episode. If you'd like to support us through Patreon, you can find us there at Brutal, Bizarre, and Boozy Podcast, or use the link in our show notes.
Hey, Gemma.
Oh, hey, Lana.
What can we expect from this season of I Think My Fridge is Haunted?
I'm glad you asked, because I'll be covering the Great Plague of London, the worst husband in Australia, and the Salem Witch Trials.
And I'll be telling stories of the notorious Hellfire Club, glitches in the Matrix, and America's largest kidnapping case.
Join us for I Think My Fridge is Haunted, a very creepy podcast for very creepy people.
Find us on all major podcasting platforms, and now you can even watch our episodes on our YouTube channel.
Until then,
be creepy,
but don't be a creep.
Welcome to the Getting Down and Wordy podcast ad.
What do we do on this podcast?
Well, it's the first Edamusical podcast.
Can you try that again in real words so that people can understand?
Fine. We talk about the intersection of popular music and language.
Oh, can we also talk about Eurovision?
Okay.
Find us on Apple and Spotify.
We are a Podmoth Network podcast.
Welcome back, everybody. Thanks for joining us once again for some more brutal, bizarre, and boozy stories.
Yes, gotta love the booziness.
Yes. What story do you have for us today, Mom?
I have a weird story. In honor of Thanksgiving, because this is coming out right before Thanksgiving. So I am going to do a story about a Thanksgiving tradition.
Interesting.
Yes. I'm going to leave it at that and let everyone tune in to hear my part. So if you're one of the people who only comes for the brutal stories, this is going to be a weird little history lesson in mine, but it's going to be, it's fun. When I told your dad I was doing this story, he looked at me like I was nuts. And then I explained it, and he was like, oh, okay, I get it. That is fun.
Okay. I'm excited to hear that then.
Cool.
I will be talking about the anthrax attacks.
I don't like it.
Yeah, pretty scary. But to go with that, the name of this cocktail is a little weird. It's Armed and Dangerous / Anthrax. So a little on the nose for my story,
it's such a weird name for it to be so long.
Yeah, I don't know. Because there's a couple other anthrax style cocktails and they were like gnarly sounding, like mix rum and Jaeger and whiskey all in one shot glass. I'm like, ugh, I don't know.
This sounds pretty weird and could be
it
gross.
Sounds okay.
Too.
Yeah, it sounds better than the other one. Depending on the size of cup you use, it could be fine.
Yeah.
So the Armed and Dangerous Anthrax consists of 1 ounce of rye whiskey, 1 ounce of Jägermeister. Add that in a glass with ice and top with cola.
Okay, here we go.
Let's give it a try.
Interesting. Well,
it's pretty mediocre.
It is. I thought I would hate it more than I do. It's not terrible.
It's not horrible. It could be better for sure.
You could drown out the alcohol flavor by just putting a lot more Coke in because it's not a measured amount of Coke or cola.
Yeah.
Sorry, cola. I mean, I guess you could put Pepsi in it, but I'm not a Pepsi drinker,
who
and
drinks
that sounds
Pepsi?
Gross. I know. Weird people.
Shame on you if you drink Pepsi.
Thank you.
Okay, let's talk about my anthrax story.
Here we go. Yeeks.
So, only a week after the attacks on the World Trade Center, a second terrorist attack took place on American soil. I think it was kind of overshadowed by 9/11 since it happened so quick after it.
I knew there were anthrax attacks after 9/11, but I didn't realize it was that fast. Like, there must have been multiple. I remember months later, but not right away.
Well, we'll get into that.
Okay.
Okay. So a set of five letters were mailed from Trenton, New Jersey. New Jersey. Yeah.
To move the to letters... the East Coast all of a sudden. New Jersey.
The letters were postmarked as being received on September 18th, 2001, and delivered to their intended recipients. The letters made their way to ABC News, CBS News, NBC News, The New York Post, and The National Enquirer at American Media Incorporated, also known as AMI, who I guess they produce a bunch of different tabloids.
Okay.
Like,
that's a lot of targets.
Yeah. So the first victim was a man named Robert Stevens, who worked at The Sun, which is distributed by AMI.
So basically, like, all of the tabloid stuff that you see at the grocery store is all from the same company, huh?
Well, other than, like, the big ones like New York Post and all that stuff.
Well, but that's not really a tabloid. I'm thinking, like, The Enquirer and The Sun. The stuff that you see when you're at the checkout line that you go, that can't possibly be true. That's bullshit.
Yeah. Shortly after opening the mysterious letter, Robert began violently throwing up and became short of breath.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. He was rushed to the hospital where he died 4 days later from an unidentified illness.
Oh.
It was presumed that the letters to ABC, CBS, and AMI all contained anthrax because each location had someone infected with anthrax. However, the letters were never recovered from those three locations.
Okay.
Yeah. Anthrax is a type of bacteria that formed spores that can affect both humans and animals and can be contracted by inhaling the spores or coming in contact with the bacteria if you have a cut.
Oh.
And I guess they're different. Like, the inhaled anthrax is a lot harder to treat. And that was the type that was used in these attacks.
Okay.
When word got out about the deaths, people started to become suspicious of their mail. The two letters that were sent to New York Post and NBC were identified and submitted for investigation before they were even opened.
Oh, good.
So, yeah, good. Luckily those got caught, but...
What flagged them? Do you have any details of what flagged those specific? Because I'm sure they're getting hundreds of pieces of mail a day.
Yeah.
Like,
I don't know what flagged them. I think since they were all postmarked from Trenton, New Jersey, they might have caught that.
Okay.
I don't know how big Trenton is. I think it's their capital, so it's probably fairly big.
I don't know. But, I mean, you're not probably getting a lot of mail from Trenton, New Jersey.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to, like, any other place in the damn country.
True. The envelope contained a small brown granular chunk similar to dog food as well as a letter. The letter read as such. 9/11/01. This is next. Take penicillin now. Death to America. Death to Israel. Allah is great.
Bad word. Okay.
I'm pretty sure I would tell the hospital when I got there, it's like, this letter said, take penicillin. Can you give me some?
Yeah.
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 Which is also weird. If you're trying to kill someone with anthrax, why would you tell them how to cure it? And like...
For the factor that it's going to scare the living shit out of thousands of people.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, penicillin like heals a lot of stuff. So I don't...
Yeah.
My first thought wouldn't necessarily be, oh, this letter has anthrax in it.
Right.
But
Yikes.
I don't know. Just, it's super weird. So, after the letters were examined by the FBI, they formally launched an investigation into the matter. 3 weeks after the first round of letters, two more letters were mailed to Senators Tom Daschle and Patrick Leahy on October 9th, 2001. So, a couple weeks after.
Okay.
Tom was the Senate Majority Leader, and Patrick was the head of the Senate Judiciary Committee. The letter addressed to Tom was opened by an aide named Grant Leslie on October 15th and was rushed to the hospital after becoming sick. After news of another attack got around, the U.S. mail services were locked down so they could stop the spread of more letters. The letter addressed to Patrick was intercepted on November 16th after it had been misdirected due to the postal code being read wrong. The two letters were examined, and it was discovered that they contained a refined form of anthrax that was significantly more potent than the first set of letters.
Great. So it's not bad enough to send it, but then you got to send a super strain of it. Fuck you.
And there was, I'm going to get into it a little bit, but it was really confusing because I'm not an infectious disease doctor.
So right. You're not really a microbiologist.
And I'll get into it anyways, but okay. This time the letters read as 9/11/01. You cannot stop us. We have this anthrax. You die now. Are you afraid? ? Death to America. Death to Israel. Allah is great. So a lot of the similar things as the first set of letters, but there was some changes in it. At least 22 people developed an anthrax infection from these letters.
Wow.
Five sadly lost their life in the infection. Robert Stevens, the one at AMI who opened the letter. Two employees at the Brentwood Mail Facility in Washington, D.C., as well as two individuals who had no direct connection to the letters at all. Kathleen Nguyen, I struggle with this name pronunciation. We got a couple people at my work who have it. And Kathy Nguyen, who worked in New York City, and Otley Lundgren, who was the widow of a judge from Connecticut. So the letters were never sent to them, so it was a little strange on how they got infected.
Right. Exposure. Right. That's weird.
Because, so whoever sent them knew that it could potentially spread, so they taped over all the openings on the letter. Because, a letter has, on the backside, there's, little lines where it's glued together and stuff.
Yeah.
And they had taped over all the possible holes that it could leak out of to ensure that it didn't contaminate everything. So it's a little weird how they got infected, but the set of letters had some variance between them. The writing on the letters sent to Tom and Patrick was about half the size of the originals and contained punctuation. So, are you scared now? ? Yeah. Maybe the FBI didn't necessarily rule out that they were different writers. It was just they were different in a noticeable way.
Okay.
The letters to Tom and Patrick had a return address of 4th grade, Greendale High School, Franklin Park, New Jersey, 08852.
What?
This return address was all messed up because the postal code that they provided was for Monmouth Junction, New Jersey, not Franklin Park.
Hmm.
There's also no Greendale High School in either towns, but there is a Greenbrook Elementary School in the nearby town of South Brunswick, New Jersey. So it was just a bunch of weird, the return address was all messed up. The anthrax in the packages was a specific strain of anthrax called Ames and was collected by a cow in Texas in 1981 and developed by the United States Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Disease in Fort Detrick, Maryland, meaning that the strain of anthrax used in the attacks was developed by the Army.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, super weird. That's the That's a weird, weird part of this story.
Yeah.
Like, well, conspiracy brain gets crazy.
Yeah, true.
The anthrax samples were sent back to Fort Detrick to be examined, and it was discovered that the anthrax had been mixed with silicon or powdered glass.
Oh.
So I'm not, like I said before, I'm not an infectious disease doctor, but I would assume that powdered glass, if it is inhaled, creates micro cuts that would allow the anthrax to infect you easier. I don't know.
I don't like that.
The legitimacy of that statement, but.
Oh, I don't like that.
I don't like that either. So here's another thing that's strange in this story. The FBI and CDC authorized the destruction of over 100 vials of anthrax at Iowa State University. And October 10th and 11th of 2001, the vials were destroyed and disposed of.
Sure they were.
Experts claim that the archives of anthrax would help determine the state of the anthrax used and could provide answers as to who was behind these attacks. So a lot of people who were like, you have all these samples of anthrax that have been archived for forever. You'd be able to tell what strain,
right?
What type. I don't know the terms. But
yeah, I get what you're saying.
It'd help you pinpoint kind of where it came from.
Right.
And like who manipulated it. With the attack starting a week after 9/11 and the contents of the letters, it was originally suspected that Al-Qaeda was responsible for the attacks. But the FBI disagreed, stating that the anthrax would require some advanced equipment, and they didn't think Al-Qaeda possessed that equipment.
I don't like assuming what someone can or can't do.
Okay,
and then just ruling
one
them
of the
out.
Directors put this. I'm not going to say this. I don't know if this is racist or not, but one of the directors said they couldn't have made this in a cave. So
I get what they're saying in that regard, but to assume that they're all in caves is kind of short-sighted.
Yeah, because they were working with Iran government and. Or maybe
right. they were
I get
working,
those two mixed up. That,
hello,
yeah.
They were in a... I mean, we had terrorists living in U.S. houses. I don't know about that. Okay.
I don't know about that either. That's, I just thought I'd put it in there, but...
Yeah.
In 2006, Bruce Edward Ivins became the lead suspect. Bruce had worked in the biodefense research lab at Fort Detrick for 18 years as a biodefense researcher. He wasn't the one working on the anthrax, but he was developing vaccines for biological weapons.
Okay.
So it would be assumed that he would have some sort of knowledge on how that stuff would work.
Yeah, makes sense.
During their investigation, the FBI raided Bruce's house twice, which arguably led to his hospitalization for depression. But this wasn't Bruce's first brush with mental health. Over a year before the attacks, Bruce had told a therapist that he had mixed poison and was going to a soccer game of a woman he was interested in. He told the therapist that if she lost the game, he had planned on poisoning her.
What?
Yeah.
Okay. That's not the proper way to date. Just saying.
No.
Haven't dated in a long time, but I'm pretty sure that's not the right way.
And therapists have like the obligation, if you're going to hurt yourself or someone else, they have to tell the police. So like.
I believe so. Yeah. Maybe I'm wrong. I'm not a therapist. I don't know.
So the therapist did actually tell the police. However, nothing was done with this information because they didn't have the name of the woman that he was threatening.
Okay.
So. In 2008, a different therapist filed a restraining order on Bruce after he threatened to kill his coworkers and go out in, quote, a blaze of glory.
Oh, no. Don't say things like that.
On August 1st, 2008, it was reported that Bruce had committed suicide by overdosing on Tylenol.
Oh.
5 days later, the federal prosecutors declared Bruce the sole proprietor of the 2001 anthrax attacks. which to me seems a bit fishy that they would wait till after he's dead to announce that he's the sole suspect.
Yeah.
There goes his right to a speedy trial. Conspiracy brain goes a little crazy. CIA killed him, blamed it on overdose. Yeah. I don't have any solid information for this. That's just what my brain tells me.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I get it. Yikes.
Yeah.
I keep going back to the OD on Tylenol. That's a lot of Tylenol.
A whole bottle.
Or more. That's like the Costco-sized bottle.
Yeah.
That you take all at one time.
There'd be a lot easier things to overdose on.
Right. I don't know. I mean, obviously, I think it is possible, but it's pretty rare. I don't know.
I mean, overdosing on that would cause to liver and kidney failure, most likely, because that's what
it's more long-term, right?
Yeah, it wouldn't just be you don't wake up the next day.
I don't know. I don't know how that works.
I guess it is a blood thinner, so maybe if you take enough, it would. I don't know, man. It seems fishy to me. That's all I'm saying.
I don't know how that works.
I don't know. That's the first time I've ever heard of someone overdosing on Tylenol.
Yeah, same.
I know you can like destroy your liver and kidneys, but that's a long process.
Right. And you got to do other shit to mess with your kidneys and liver by taking excessive amounts of Tylenol. There's got to be other things involved, like alcohol and other drugs that your body is just like, okay, we've had enough. But I mean, I don't know because I don't deal with that kind of stuff. And I'm a rule follower. If it says take two tablets, I'm going to take two tablets and especially I'm not going to deviate from that.
Tylenol's a gross drug. It does gross things to you.
The only time I take Tylenol is for a migraine.
Yeah. If I really need to, I'll take it, but I try and avoid it.
Same.
Yeah. But that's the 2001 anthrax attacks.
That's pretty nasty. More unanswered question. Okay. You got to come with some answers next time, Declan. You keep bringing these.
Hey, they said that guy did it. He was a sole proprietor. I gave you an answer. You might not like it.
All right. That's true. But then you said conspiracy brain says no.
Yeah, because the government's not going to say, hey, we actually did this. But
no, of course not. I think what's probably fairly more likely is that they didn't keep as close an eye on it as they thought they were, and some bad person got a hold of it, and they didn't want to admit that they fucked up by not paying attention to it.
So the vial that they believe the anthrax came from, I think they found it was 419 people had access to it in the laboratory.
Yeah.
But he was the biggest suspect, so.
Okay.
There's been some.
Conveniently had some mental illness as well, so nice.
And yeah. There's nice also scapegoat. Been some other stories that I might cover later on about the Army testing anthrax in the New York subway.
Oh, I don't like that either.
So, well, maybe we'll get to that, but.
Yikes. A part two. Actually, on
I don't know if it was anthrax, but something similar, like a bad bacteria or some shit like that. But there's been some government testing with bacteria. That's all I'll say for now because I don't know the full story.
I'm gonna have to research this, but I want to say that there's a conspiracy theory about. I can't remember, but it's a bacteria that like lives oftentimes in like heating and air vac, like HVAC systems, Legionnaire's disease. I think there's a conspiracy about that. So maybe I'll have to look into that for a future episode.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't want to be tested on. I mean,
well, just to let you know, government tests a lot of stuff without us knowing.
Oh, 100%. For sure. Yeah. For sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow.
All right, let's get into your story.
Okay, let's do something more lighthearted.
Yes.
Like I said, this is for in honor of our Thanksgiving episode. Originally, I had another story planned for this recording, and then I went, oh, wait, it's Thanksgiving. We have to do a Thanksgiving episode or a story for Thanksgiving, and we've done Thanksgiving stuff each year before. So I tasked myself with finding something Thanksgiving related, and I came up with presidential turkey pardons.
Okay.
Okay. Are we ready?
Yes.
It is a peculiar American tradition, and we're going to talk about the history of it. So we've talked about the history of Thanksgiving. Last year, we talked about Plymouth, Massachusetts in an episode, and we talked about how that related to like ghosts and things. As a little recap for those who have heard it, we also talked about ghosts and haunted places in relation to Plymouth, Massachusetts, which is considered the town that was first founded by colonists or colonialists. For those who haven't heard that episode, please go listen to it. We talked about some spooky stories and some historical chat about the Pilgrims and the Native Americans. So basically the holiday Thanksgiving started with feasts, Native American lore and Pilgrims, as we have said. Fast forward to today, and somehow we're in a world where the president of the United States is giving formal pardons to turkeys. Yes, the bird that many people eat on Thanksgiving. A live turkey is often standing in front of the commander-in-chief on the White House lawn, getting a pass from ending up on someone's dinner table. But how did this oddball tradition get started? So, to understand that, we've got to go back to the 1800s, where it all begins with a man who was no stranger to intense American traditions, and that is President Abraham Lincoln. President Lincoln was the 16th president of the U.S. and was often referred to as Honest Abe. He was known for his stovepipe hat, but not necessarily his culinary tastes. The story goes that in 1863, Lincoln's son, Tad, who was 10 years old at the time, was given a turkey around Thanksgiving time. Now, not just a turkey, but a live turkey, which begs the question, who gives a 10-year-old a live turkey? Or even a roasted turkey, a turkey. Who gives a 10-year-old a turkey? That's weird.
Fucking hate turkeys. Turkeys are assholes.
Live turkeys, yes. But dead turkeys taste really good for those of us who are not vegetarian or vegan. I do love a turkey.
Well, arguably. They're if the worst properly. Bird to cook.
If cooked properly.
It's such a big bird and it dries out so quick, so a lot of people fuck it up. But
yes. We have had a few occasional bad turkeys on Thanksgiving. We won't name names, but we have had some bad turkeys. So Tad, being just a kid, did what any young child would do. He made it a pet, and he gave it a name. The turkey's name was Jack. Jack the turkey.
So a little personal story of mine. At my old job, we had a turkey that would roost up in a tree outside of a building on campus. And he would attack anyone that came in and out of the building. So we would be called to come chase the turkey away. And we had a giant butterfly net. This is like some Looney Tunes shit. We had a giant butterfly net, and someone would be driving the golf cart, and the other person would have the net, and we'd try and catch the turkey in the net.
Oh my God.
And this was the same turkey. He would like block the parking lot and just peck at people's cars. So
it's
like
the same turkey.
People who, yeah, he's just a dickhead.
He's a mean turkey.
But he would block, and people obviously don't want to run over a turkey, but he's just standing there with his like wings out and just pecking their bumpers and tires and stuff. So we'd have to go chase him off of the cars. So people had fucking hate turkeys.
You had a lot of turkeys on that campus.
Yeah, one was particularly rude.
Yeah, he sounds like not a nice turkey. It's not Jack the turkey. Did you guys name him? Like, was he asshole turkey or?
I think we just went with Tom because that's what you call male turkeys. But
Tom turkey.
Yeah.
So, as the story goes with Jack and Tad, when the White House kitchen staff prepared to slaughter Jack for dinner, young Tad was horrified. He ran to his dad, begging him to spare the feathery friend's life. Lincoln, ever the soft-hearted dad, agreed, and he pardoned the turkey, sparing Jack from the culinary table. Now, was this the first official presidential pardon? Not exactly. But it was the first time a sitting president intervened on behalf of a turkey. And hey, we'll count that as a precursor. The idea of giving a fully dressed and cooked turkey to the president began in 1873 by a Rhode Island turkey farmer. It continued until 1913 when that farmer passed away. Other turkey farmers believed that they had better quality turkeys. So it was like turkey wars. My turkey tastes better than your turkey. And it soon became a rivalry between the farmers as to who would supply the president with the Thanksgiving feast. However, the turkeys being sent to the White House eventually became live turkeys that were sent from hundreds of miles away. Now, skipping forward to the 1940s, Harry Truman, the 33rd president, gets credit for quote unquote starting the tradition. But here's the twist. Truman didn't pardon any turkeys. In fact, he ate them. So he was getting the turkeys and then just eating them anyway.
So the White House just receives like 40 turkeys and they have to choose one to pardon. Is that what I'm understanding?
No. They actually develop the current tradition is they develop like here's two turkeys. They now have two turkeys. And they select which turkeys are going to be sent to the president alive. By that time, when Truman was in office, the National Turkey Federation took over supplying the gifted turkey to the president each year. These turkey donations were meant to symbolize abundance in post-World War II America, and it was basically a giant PR move. They were like, look at us, we're being nice, and turkeys are great, but the president is better because he's pardoning a turkey. The Federation would bring a turkey to the White House as a photo op, and then the bird would become Thanksgiving dinner for the Truman family. So they were like, look
reverse
at our turkey.
Pardoning.
This is great.
Instead of getting free, he's getting the death sentence.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So it wasn't the pardon, but it was still a big ceremony. And, you know, it ended up that the bird ended up getting killed anyway. So. Somehow in the chaos of history and retelling of stories, Truman ended up getting credit for creating the turkey pardon idea, even though he was more of the turkey eater than the turkey savior. In 1963, President John F. Kennedy made history when he was presented with a turkey and casually remarked, "Let's keep him going," end quote. No press release, no official statement, just a passing comment from JFK saying essentially, let's let him live. And the turkey lived. Once again,
rumor
the turkey
has it the CIA also shot that turkey in the head later.
No. Hopefully not. The turkey, supposedly, the turkey went on to live another day, but JFK didn't call it a pardon. They just, you know, that's officially what it was ruled. In fact, he never made any formal proclamation at all about the turkey. Still, people looked at that moment as a hint toward what would become the official tradition. It wasn't quite a pardon, but it was a step closer. In more recent history, the tradition of a presidential turkey pardon gained popularity with President Ronald Reagan. During his presidency, he gave more regular pardons, basically every year, than the previous presidents, where it was kind of hit or miss. The presidential turkey pardon we know today actually started with George H.W. Bush, that would be President Bush Sr. In 1989, Bush Sr. received the Thanksgiving turkey from the National Turkey Federation, and he decided to announce to the press on the record that the turkey would be spared. He even threw in a bit of humor, saying the bird would go to a petting zoo instead of a dinner table.
Just terrorizing children?
Pretty much, yep.
Okay.
Bush was the first president to make the pardon official, and he did it partly because animal rights activists had been gaining traction in the 1980s. They were protesting outside the White House on Thanksgiving and advocating for the turkey's life. So basically, he turned it into granting clemency for the bird and avoiding a giant PR disaster. And thus, the turkey pardon became an official annual event. From that point forward, the turkey pardon was in the books, something the president would do every year, a small act of mercy and a moment of holiday absurdity, because it is pretty absurd. Once Bush Sr. set the stage, presidents after him continued the tradition with their own quirky spins. Bill Clinton leaned into the humor of the moment, making jokes with reporters, while George W. Bush treated the ceremony with a level of seriousness, quote unquote seriousness, that made it feel more like satire. Obama, true to his style, turned the whole thing into a family affair, often bringing his daughters along and cracking jokes to the press. Originally, there was just a single bird given the pardon, but in recent decades, there have been two birds given the pardon. By now, the turkeys pardoned by the president don't wander off into the woods. They're given like pretty good treatment. The lucky birds are often sent to places like petting zoos, as you said, terrifying small children. Some have been sent to Walt Disney World. Yes, Walt Disney World, which is weird. We've been to Disney World and I don't remember seeing turkeys, but maybe they're in a different part. In fact, some turkeys have received so much celebrity treatment that they've even been flown first class to their new homes, which is bullshit. Don't send turkeys first class. To personalize the turkeys further, these pardoned birds are given names. The naming selection process is conducted by the White House staff. They choose from name suggestions given by school children in the state where the birds were raised. In recent years, names have ranged from the whimsical to the downright silly. Some pairs include peanut butter and jelly, or mac and cheese, and even tater and tot. Yeah. Pardoning ceremony is often humorous in nature, with the president making jokes about the bird. Sometimes the table gets turned and the bird is the jokester. One year, a turkey flapped its wings so aggressively it knocked a reporter's microphone out of her hands, making for a hilarious live TV moment. There's also a weird twist. These turkeys, despite being saved from Thanksgiving tables, don't tend to live very long after their pardons. Because modern turkeys for the table, for example, are bred to be larger and heavier than wild turkeys. So you get more meat on your bird, basically, and you can feed more people at Thanksgiving, which means that they're fed really crappy food and overfed, and it causes them to develop health problems. So in a bittersweet twist to the story, the very creatures that are getting their get out of dinner free card often end up with a shorter shelf life and usually die within a couple of years, which is about half the time that a wild or heritage turkey survives. The trend is not just reserved for presidents, though. Several individual states have adopted the practice. At least 10 states have started the tradition, and either the governor or another public official gives the turkey his pardon, his or her pardon. So
the whole pardon thing is weird.
It's super weird. It's super strange. But, you know, I had to bust out something for Thanksgiving.
Another story I want to do is the Iran-Contra thing, and Bush Sr. pardoned 6 people for that. So maybe we'll tie that all in together. And...
Oh.
Yeah.
Fine.
But I don't like the whole presidential pardon thing. Like, you just get to skip all judicial course of action just because the president said so.
I think typically they're already in prison, and the presidential pardon comes in like, we're going to let you go. You've been in prison a while. But I honestly don't know. I have no clue. That's what I assumed. I thought it was somebody who was in prison already. And because that's kind of what happens on the state level, where like convicted murderers and such ask for a pardon from the governor to get off a death row. I think we talked about that long time ago in one of our first episodes, where one of the murderers had asked for clemency and pardon from the governor, and the governor ignored him.
I think there was one person, I think Clinton pardoned someone who was not even charged yet.
Oh.
Yeah, so I think they can do, well, it was his friend, so
in advance. I know you're going to get in trouble for this in the future, so I'm pardoning you in advance in case charges do come down. That's fucked up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Get out of jail free card in case, just in case. I don't like that.
Well, okay, looking more into it, I guess the dude fled to Switzerland and was living there for 17 years, so he couldn't get charged. And then Bill Clinton pardoned him.
Said, okay, you're...
A little sketchy, a little sketchy.
Interesting.
Because they were friends, too. A little strange.
Oh, it's pays to have friends in high places.
Yeah. Not much higher than the president, so...
Right.
It's a good friend to have.
Yeah.
You have a chaser for us, Mom?
I do have a chaser. It is another watch recommendation because, you know, the weather's gross right now and all I do is sit inside and watch TV, apparently. Mine is the movie recommendation on Max, the movie Wolfs with Brad Pitt and George Clooney.
On Apple?
No, it's on Max, maybe? I think it's on Max.
I don't think so.
It's on one of those.
I'm fairly certain it's on Apple because I had to wait for it. And I asked Carter like 3 times if he had an Apple subscription. And he kept reminding me.
That could be. I don't know. It's on a channel.
Yeah, it's a really good movie, though.
It's a good movie. I really liked it. I didn't read the description. I don't know why I assumed it was a heist movie. So when it turned out it was a fixer movie, I was pleasantly surprised.
Yeah.
That I hadn't read the description, but I really liked it. It was good.
It kind of gave me the same vibes as The True Story with Kevin Hart.
Oh.
Where he had to get rid of the dead girl in his hotel room.
That's true.
Yeah, that was a good show.
Very similar. I do wonder why they named it Wolfs instead of Wolves. And yes, there is a delineation there. And my grammatic brain goes a little twitchy when I see it as Wolfs instead of Wolves, but whatever. Yeah. I'm sure there's a reason and rationale behind the naming of it that way, but it does make
they're
me
lone
kind of
wolves.
Go, maybe. I don't know. The plural, whatever, but yeah. Do you have a chaser for us?
I do. My chaser is an Instagram account by the name of Elias_films with a Z at the end. Oh. And he does a couple different things. My favorite series on his channel is he does cooking videos with his cow. So what? He has a full grown beef cow.
Why?
That okay, he'll weird. Like, he brings it into his house and he like, he'll be making like, oh, today we're going to make pasta. And the cow is trying to eat every single thing that he's trying to cook with. So like if he's got a bowl of oats, making oatmeal, the cow just starts mm-hmm. eating the oats and he has to fight the cow off while he's trying to cook. And like, it looks very unsanitary, but
oh, 100%.
It's a really funny video because he's just grappling with the cow while trying to cook. And the cow is just like mindlessly trying to eat everything in the house. It's nice. Pretty funny. But he does other things like getting a haircut with his cow and he'll dress it up for Halloween and stuff. It's pretty funny, pretty entertaining.
He's
very account.
Attached to his cow.
Yes. And the cow seems attached to him because he's allowed in the house, which is.
That's sweet. Okay,
I feel like
no.
the bust through the floor. Like, cows are big.
Maybe he has. Maybe he has.
Like a farmhouse. Yeah. Yeah. Maybe.
That's the style, you know.
It's a funny watch.
Okay, I'll have to check it out.
Well, I think that brings us to the end of another good episode. Thanks for joining us, everybody.
Thank you.
Yeah, I love you, Mom.
Love you too, bud.
Bye.
Bye. Hey, friends. Thank you for supporting our podcast. Please share our show with your brutal and bizarre friends. Give us a boozy follow on your favorite podcast platform. If you're feeling extra generous, we'd appreciate a 5-star rating or review as well. But maybe do that sober so all the letters are in the right place.
You can find all our contact information in the show notes. We love hearing from you, and if you're interested in helping us stock the bar for our future boozy episodes, you can find our Patreon link in the show notes as well.